Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. We are going to play the second part of my interview with Wayne Jett. This is on the events leading up to the Great Depression and things that happened in the Great Depression. I've got to tell you, I've had more positive responses from this interview than I've had from any interview that I've done. So I highly recommend, if you haven't heard the first part, go to my website, sarahwestall.com, and listen to that first part. You can listen to the second part again as well. I will have both of them up on podcast, and of course you can get them on the 100 different places my podcast streams and is in podcast form, and also on YouTube. But this is really a very interesting interview. Lots of new information that most people haven't heard about from the Great Depression. It's actually sad when you realize what really happened. And it's almost like it's been written out of history, but all of this stuff is very well researched and everything is documented. You can go and you can back up these facts if you want, because they're all true. He didn't make anything up. It's all there in historical records. So let's not waste much more time and let's get back into my interview with Wayne Jett.
Well, how did they justify that to the people when they were starving? Couldn't even feed themselves, couldn't pay their rents, couldn't do the basic things they need to survive.
Well, they didn't justify it. That is why Roosevelt came in, even though he was suspected of being a guy who's by reputation, his reputation was he looked down his nose at everybody. That was his reputation in the New York State Senate when he served there. But this time he had polio, and was understood to be paralyzed and thought to be somehow or other. He was preaching that he was a man of the people and wanted to look out for the common man. But he gave some private speeches in New York and in San Francisco to let them know that he was actually on the side of the mercantilists, that he was of the view that the economy had become much too large and needed to be downsized. It had gotten way too large, and therefore would never again be the same size. So that's what he was telling in secret. But nevertheless, he won in a landslide in 1932. Now, in that circumstance, what does he begin doing to add to what Hoover had done to get the depression going? Despite those three things that Hoover did, his 4 years were spent essentially acting like an engineer, trying to fix every little thing with social programs of various kinds, while the big things that he did had put us on our back economically. Here comes Roosevelt. And the first thing he does is, of course, he declares the bank holiday, and they let some banks reopen. They close a lot of them as supposedly financially unsound. But then he orders that it's no longer permissible for private citizens to own gold. Everyone was to turn in their gold to the Federal Reserve banks or to any bank, and they would be paid the going rate for it as it had been from the beginning of the Federal Reserve and actually all the way back to the Civil War and before. The dollar was worth $20.67 per ounce of gold. That, of course, was a very high value for the dollar in relation to where we are now, because the dollar has been so sucked away by inflation. But they would get $20.67 for every ounce of gold they had, and if you did not turn it in, you were subject to a major fine and in federal prison. So it was a mandate that everyone turn in their gold. Now, you understand that when the economy crashed and the economic displacement after the crash, many factories had to close because of the loss of export-import trade. Many businesses had to shut down. They liquidated whatever they could, and whatever capital that was raised from those sales of businesses, the owners of that capital tried to preserve it. And since Roosevelt was giving hints of devaluation of the currency, they bought gold in order to protect themselves. There wasn't anything else they could invest in, so they bought gold. Well, they had to turn it all over at $20.67. That happened in 1933, between March 15th, when he was sworn in as president, and November, he was able to get essentially all the gold into the Federal Reserve and then the Federal Treasury. And once it was in the hands of the government, on January 31st of 1934, Roosevelt devalued the dollar, some would say by about 60%. I say in my book, a different way of calculating it, that it was essentially 41%. And so therefore, those people who had the dollars in their pockets, it would then take them at this point, even if they were permitted to buy it, it would take $35 to buy the same amount of gold.
Yeah, so it essentially went from 26 to 35, and immediately overnight, everybody lost what they had by 41%.
That's correct. The effect of that devaluation, it was very carefully designed. People today think of devaluation as people putting more money out. Like the Federal Reserve talks of devaluation today by a helicopter drop, putting more money into the economy. That's precisely what Roosevelt did not do. He insisted there would not be a single new dollar put into the economy. He simply transferred 41% of the value of the capital that people had into the Treasury reserves.
Into the Federal Reserve. Coupled with much, much higher taxes and this gold take, how come there wasn't a revolution or a huge backlash?
Well, there were backlashes of its type, but by and large, people that did a little feeding of people. But I'm glad you asked that particular question, because people today particularly really do not understand how severe the Depression was. I'll get into it with some of the additional actions he took. For example, one of the primary things about that devaluation, not only did it take 41% of the private capital out of the country and put it in the National Treasury, it had the effect that the currencies of other nations were that much more valuable in comparison to the dollar. Therefore, the food could be sold overseas at a greater profit than within America. And so the food produced by American farmers would be sold overseas while people here at home were starving. Mm. Now, there were journalists at the time who reported, for example, that children on the Great Plains of the United States, you know, that's an agricultural region. You'd think the food would be plentiful. That children on the Great Plains belonging to farmers there were being fed bramble weeds put into water and heated to make a so-called soup or stew in order to have something in their stomachs. That is how it was. It wasn't just that people starved to death. And in that circumstance, there have been no social scientists, to my knowledge, in the United States who have made a careful study of how many people we actually lost to starvation. There have been two studies that I know about, one done before my book came out by a German social scientist. His conclusions were based on the best numbers that he could find in the reports available, were that 3 million or more starved to death.
So
Since
when we saw North Korea with all those dying people in the 1990s and it was all over television, our situation was worse than that.
That is correct. And there has been another social study done by a Russian social scientist since my book came out. His numbers are at least 6 million died of starvation and
Do other
related
do other
illnesses.
do other countries know our history more than we know our history?
I'm convinced that they do. They know it much better. In fact, they know current events much better than we do. Our media is completely effectively controlled by the ruling elite. They are an arm of the people who also control the major banks, both political parties. If ever there was a political lesson to be learned, there was one that was right in front of our faces in 2016, and that was the spectacle of the head families of the Republican Party, the Bushes, walking from the Republican Party over to support Hillary Clinton because an outsider had been nominated by the Republican voters. Now, that is a lesson that tells you there is only one establishment. I've been writing about it for some years. There are not two establishments, not a Democrat establishment and then a separate Republican establishment. They just use different names and different people, but the same puppet masters control both parties, and they certainly expressed their intent to do so as far back as 1880, that they couldn't take a chance any longer that a renegade party could actually come up and nominate someone. Actually, in 1880, a runaway convention nominated James Garfield, who was not the party chosen by the ruling elite. They shot him within 3 months after he took office. Part of the reason was because he said he was going to refinance the National Treasury. He was going to redo their approach to currency and so forth. And that, of course, was not permitted. It was a lone gunman, crazed person, and so forth. Same story that we get each time. Same story we got for JFK. JFK, of course, was the son of a man who was supposedly a part of that ruling establishment, one of the major operatives, Joseph P. Kennedy. But the ethics and morality of John F. Kennedy appeared to be substantially different. He expressed during his period in office that he was going to end this kind of thing, that he was going to end the Federal Reserve. He was going to put currency and money back into the U.S. Treasury and cut out the fiat money that we have still now. He was going to do a number of such things, including ending the war in Vietnam. Again, a so-called single crazed gunman, which is
Widely
another
debunked.
widely debunked story that resulted in the death of another president willing to take action actually on behalf of the people. But I want to get back to the things that Roosevelt did. I've only begun on that line. One of the things I want to mention is that he didn't stop with the tax increase of 1932 that Hoover had signed off on. Roosevelt wound up staying in office, being reelected at least for 4 terms. He died in his fourth term, and every year of his presidency, he raised taxes or added taxes or both, except for one year, 1939. I'll tell you more about exactly the circumstances of that a little bit later, but Congress refused to raise taxes that year after the Democrats in the House had lost 83 seats in the elections of 1938. That was the previous high that we did not quite exceed in a more recent year, I think maybe 2010, in which the Democrats lost, I think, 81 seats or something like that. The people were sick and tired. They didn't believe anymore. They believed Roosevelt to be an imposter and so forth, the ones that really were watching what was going on. And yet he was able somehow to, time after time, whether by hook or crook, to be reelected. But those tax increases put the highest rate up to as high as, I think, 91-92% on earned income under
crazy.
Roosevelt.
That's absolutely crazy. What were people supposed to do?
Yeah. And again, another big lie. I've just got to get off into it for a second, that the war, World War II, ended the Great Depression. No, it didn't. It took all of the unemployed men over to be shot at and killed. Just in large part, as World War I was another war contrived by the ruling elite in order to not just rearrange the powers and who held powers over what territory, in order to diminish human population as much as possible, since the ruling elite very much believed the Thomas Malthus stuff that Henry George showed to be completely false, that overpopulation is what causes poverty, overruns the resources of the world, and so forth. But World War
I. So how do you know that the elites did that just so those people could be killed?
Well, for example, there's a record of a letter from the Carnegie Foundation to Woodrow Wilson during World War I, telling him to make sure that the war doesn't end too soon. There are other aspects of, if you look at the numbers of people and the way the battles were waged in World War I, the numbers of casualties lost in battle, the number of battle deaths are absolutely astonishing. No person in their right mind who has their own people's welfare would conduct battles in that way. 400,000 men lost in a month in a single battle. You can go on and on. I've chronicled that in my book, a chapter on the war itself, and on the fact that it was really Franklin Roosevelt who was the great appeaser of Hitler. It was not Chamberlain in Great Britain. Chamberlain was the one trying to get together the European powers along with the U.S., and the great trouble he had, he could get the other European powers to go against Germany, but Franklin Roosevelt, absolutely not, and in fact, at the Munich a conference that I believe it was Munich that ceded Czechoslovakia to Hitler. Franklin Roosevelt had refused to communicate with the British Prime Minister in advance of that, even though he was imploring him, please join with us in confronting Hitler and making him stop these invasions. And he sent a two-word letter to Chamberlain saying, good man. That was Franklin Roosevelt. That's all the advice he gave him as he was going into the meeting with Hitler. And to Hitler, he sent him a I think a couple of paragraphs telling him that he had no involvement, nothing to say whatsoever, and no one else should speak on behalf of the United States in terms of whatever was going to be done there. In other words, assuring Hitler that the U.S. would do nothing. Those are the kinds of things that we've been misled so badly about. But
at some point, we ended up joining the war and against Germany. So how did that end up happening?
Well, we wound up going in on the basis that the United States actually provoked the war with Japan, the attack on Pearl Harbor, by number one, cutting off oil supplies. Japan had to import all of its oil, and actually had a booming economy. It was doing some aggression, no question, in Asia, but they were not going to go after the United States. But we provoked that attack and, in fact, set up the Pearl Harbor facilities to be attacked by getting the carriers out of the port so they wouldn't be attacked. There was actually even a British submarine that knew the fleet was coming from Japan and had sounded the alarm. And that submarine wound up being sabotaged and blown up by Great Britain. It was a British sub, in order to keep the word from getting out, because the intention of Pearl Harbor was to be a cause for war against Japan. There was, in fact, then a treaty between Hitler and Japan that immediately caused Hitler to declare war against the United States as soon as we declared war against Japan. So that got us into the war against Hitler. That is the way those things happened, all by plan, and as a part of the pattern of consolidating powers. There is much more to that. But if I could get to the point of again returning to the series of actions taken by Franklin Roosevelt to make sure that the Great Depression lasted for the complete duration that they wanted.
Did they end up having it for the complete duration they wanted, or was it shorter?
It was the complete duration, yes. They began pulling out of it somewhat in the early 40s as they began arming for war. And then, of course, the war industry employed more people, and they shipped off a lot of unemployed people into the war as troops. That was essentially the kind of economic development that gave rise to more employment with the preparations and the conduct of the war, the manufacturing of war materials and so forth. And of course, the defense industry, so-called, or war-making industry, is a large part of our industry now. But in order to make sure that it happened, let me give you some more of the designs. We've already talked about the way devaluation was done to strip private capital out of the economy. Then the taxes took more of the private capital out of the economy by the higher tax rates.
What did they sell to the people that the higher tax rates would do?
Supposedly, they thought they were, supposedly this was going to be to tax of people who were the richest. There were few people that were supportive of it. I think there were a couple of assassinations, in my opinion, that took place in 1936, before that election. One was the senator from Louisiana that was so-called onto FDR's schemes, who was going to run and was assassinated by another lone assassin. Another was Will Rogers, who was a very popular man, and I wouldn't at all have been surprised if he had run for president in 1936. If his plane hadn't gone down mysteriously just as about he was about to land in Alaska in 1935, 1936, I can't remember the exact date, but there was a great deal of unrest about FDR, but things kept going his way. But let me tell you more about what he did. One of the things that he did, apart from destroying food to try to so-called get prices higher for farmers, apart from all of that, destroying food while people were starving, the taxes that he used to begin buying gold. He did that as early as his first year in office. He said the theory was that if the price of gold went up, that it would cause the price of all other commodities, including farm commodities, to go up. Well, it didn't work that way at all. And of course, once he devalued the dollar and set the price of gold at $35, it could not possibly affect the economy the way he said, by buying more gold. And yet he continued buying gold throughout the 30s. He had more than doubled the amount of gold in the U.S. Treasury between 1930 and 19 by 1936, by 1935, he had already doubled the amount of gold in the U.S. Treasury from the amount of gold that we had bought in the entire history of the United States up until 1930. And he was doing that with taxes from people who were starving to death. That's the circumstance. And then did he stop that in 1935, when clearly the dollar was already set at $35 an ounce and there would be no change in that? So why did he continue to buy gold? Well, between 1936 and 1940, he doubled the entire amount of gold in the U.S. Treasury again by buying gold from abroad, so that in the first 8 years in office, he bought a total of 13,185.3 metric tons of gold. And he did that with money taken from people who were in deep depression. The reason he was able to buy the gold from other countries is they were selling their gold in order to feed their people. We were buying their gold with money taken from people who were starving to death in the United States. That was Franklin Roosevelt.
Wow. Now, who owns that gold, supposedly?
Well, it was owned by the U.S. Treasury in theory. It is now, as far as can be told by the best watchers available, there are, I think the prevailing view is that we have no gold left at all. We had it in 1940. We still had the same amount declared in 1945. From that time, there have been a number of actions at different times in which gold was made available to the ruling elite. And particularly in the Clinton administration, with Robert Rubin in office, there was, for example, a government program which permitted the gold to be leased to private parties at no interest. And somehow a large part of the gold disappeared. And the question is whether there's any left at all. I'm of the view that that we have no gold left, except whatever the Federal Reserve has been used in conjunction with our military to take gold from other countries for safekeeping. And whether that gold is still in the Federal Reserve, I don't know. Germany tried within the past 10 years to get us to return its gold that had been put with the Fed for safekeeping. And so far, they've been unsuccessful in getting very much of it back. A small part, supposedly, was returned. But the question is where the gold is, if we have any at all. The observers that I credit as having the best information indicate that the United States most likely has no gold left. The same people who brought it to bear. You understand now the significance of buying all that gold. Yes, it did starve the people by taking their money and buying gold with it. But what else it did, it destroyed the gold standard that had been the international system by which people were assured that the currency they were taking for their labor actually had value behind it. That they weren't going to wind up with just a piece of paper that somebody could say isn't worth anything because I'm not accepting it anymore. That's what we have now.
Well, again, let me ask this question. Why didn't people rise up? Why were they complacent? Because they were starving in mass and didn't have the strength? But you would think that would cause them to rise up.
Well, it may be that they are like a lot of people today, that they still believe the stories about of the people, by the people, and for the people, that we have an elected government that's really our elected representatives that try to do their best. They have good faith and so forth and so on. There were many people during the Great Depression who did not view it that way. They raised objections. They made their arguments known. There were politicians who did the same. There were politicians at the time of the Great Depression and all the way back to the 1900s, before the Federal Reserve was authorized. There were very well-informed politicians in Congress, in the Senate, and the House, who were arguing with everything they had against it. And yet, the powers who have that financial power, that tremendous pecuniary interest that Henry George wrote about, they're the ones who get put in office by the powers that be, by the ruling elite, by the establishment. They are provided their money to run for office, and they do as they're told in the elected offices, and the people at large simply don't have the means to overcome it. There are many who think that now is the best chance that we've ever had in my lifetime to possibly overturn the ruling elite. There are many who are actually saying it is so, and that we're doing it, and that it's underway. It remains to be seen the outcome. I don't believe the outcome is assured by any means at this point. But in all honesty, although there are even good friends who've shared many views with me in the past, are skeptical in terms of whether our new president is with them or against them. I think there is so much opposition from the people who are objecting so strongly to our new President Trump. I still have a reasonable level of confidence that he is our best chance to overthrow the ruling elite that we've had in my lifetime. And my lifetime stretches back to the beginning of World War II.
Well, while we still have some time, because I want to get into more of that next show, can you talk about Keynesian economics? Because one of the things that happened, and this is what you state in your book, is that he changed his philosophies during the 1930s and had a big impact on the politicians and how things went forward. Can you explain what his philosophy was before the 1930s and then what happened?
Well, I devoted a complete chapter in my book to debunking Keynesianism, but I'll tell you in a few words that the man who was the recognized international authority on mercantilism in the 1930s was a Swedish scientist, Swedish economist. And he said that it was a clear case that Keynes was simply moving from classical economics to mercantilism. And the reason that he became such a renowned economist, the greatest of the 20th century supposedly, is that he threw in with the dark side and started espousing theories that would be very beneficial to the mercantilists to cover up their real motives. The way I put it in my book is he developed theories that from an economic analysis viewpoint, it's like turning the telescope around and looking in the large end of the telescope. Everything is a lot farther off, a lot smaller, a lot more difficult to make out under Keynesianism than it is if you look through the small end of the telescope and it brings things closer. For example, the so-called great book that made him so famous, The General Theory, as he called it, of employment, interest, and money. It makes the determination of wages and what wages are so complex that you wonder how anybody ever was able to hire anybody for anything. that's the way it works. And the way it turns out with the kinds of analysis they do in Keynesian theory is that it simply allows it to be so complex that no one who is not espousing a PhD has the temerity to suggest that they can even understand it. And so therefore they have to go along. And the Keynesians are always able to come out with, here is why we want to do this policy, and it's the best thing for the people. It'll work out best. And it's always the thing that with direct classical analysis, you can tell it's the stupidest thing you can do and the most dishonest. You know, whether you're talking about high tax rates that put everybody in poverty and put the economy in the tank and put everybody on the dole and put the government in debt. You know, we are at a situation presently that we've come to by having this Keynesian economics imposed on all universities from top to bottom. As soon as the Keynesians, they were just getting into the university faculties when I was in school. And once Keynesians get in, they make sure anybody else that's hired is nothing but Keynesian.
No, but they don't do that purposely as much as that's just what they're taught and that's what they know and that's their paradigm. The economists, right?
Give a thought to what Robert David Steele said, that everybody who knows anything substantive about the Great Depression lies about it. I don't believe for a minute that I'm the first one who found what I found in looking at what was done during the period of the Great Depression to make sure it happened. I think others know about it. Ben Bernanke espouses himself to be an expert on the Great Depression. I've had a few communications through Jude Wendisky with him before he was appointed chairman of the Fed, and unless he was just playing dumb, he knew nothing at all about the reason gold is used as the measuring stick for valuing currency, because its value does not change. It's the most stable valued substance because it doesn't rust or canker or change its substance chemically. It simply stays the same. And the quantity of it is such that its value is as stable as any other thing that we can come up with as a measuring stick, so that's why it's used. It's not because it's owned by gold and by kings or anything else. It's simply a stable value, and you can therefore use it to measure how much your money is worth. And you have to keep in mind that that is exactly what a person, whether he is a single laborer trying to raise a family, or whether he is a major industrialist who's trying to decide whether it's worth it to invest $100 million worth of capital in a new plant. He wants to know what is going the money that he's going to get for the product of that plant is going to be, so he can decide whether it's worth the money to invest in the plant to build it in the first place. The man who's working in the field wants to know, if I keep this money that you're giving me for this day's work, am I going to be able eventually to spend it for something that will buy my family food? And when it's a piece of paper, it's not that thing. It has no value other than the heat you can get from it by putting it on fire or using it as wallpaper. And that is what our central banks have brought us to in designing the system as it has. The reason they do it that way is because it allows the owners of the central banks, including the Federal Reserve, to take the value of the labor of people who accept that money for their work. Whether it's an industrialist who's making products out of a plant, or whether it's the single laborer, they take that money, and then the Federal Reserve takes action to make that money worth less and less. And the way it does that, in large part, is it prints additional paper dollars and takes it for its own use.
So even if you're skeptical of what they're really doing, the final result is they're taking money from the people and giving it to themselves, right? So is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. So no matter what they say or anybody says, that's what they're doing. So at some point, it should be very obvious, at least to them, that they're taking money from the people and keeping it themselves. And so we have a system, no matter why it got created. I mean, that's what we essentially have. The owners of the central banks are taking money from the people and keeping it themselves, which itself is a bad system. No matter why it was started, the facts are we're sitting in a system that's bad.
Well, let me describe that situation with the money in a somewhat a way that fits in just with what you're saying to describe it in other words. Money is what's called fungible. In other words, every dollar is just like every other dollar. It has exactly the same value, whether it's printed yesterday or today or whatever. Everyone with a dollar or $10, $100, those dollars are worth exactly the same amount. The problem with that kind of money system is how do you keep the value of the dollar the same over a period of time so that the money does not become worthless, and therefore the people who worked really hard for it back when they were earning it, say in the 60s, by the time they get to spend it in the 90s or in 2015, it's worth almost nothing, certainly in comparison to what it was. How do you get it to stay the same? Well, with the Federal Reserve's Keynesian approach, you can't. And in fact, you don't want to. They designed it that way in order that they provide themselves as much money as they want. And when all those dollars are fungible, it means the new money that they slip out the back door to themselves or lend themselves at zero interest rate. That's another way of looking at it.
Well, and we don't know because they're not audited, right? I mean, they can do whatever they want.
That's correct. We have no idea. I can say whatever I want about what they're doing. There are certainly plenty of reports of it about the trillions of dollars that they have sent out the back door of the Fed to the big banks, the owners of the banks, the operators of the big banks. The ruling elite are not really the bankers. The bankers are their high-level operatives that make a lot of money for doing what they do, and they sit near the top of the pyramid, but they're not calling the shots. The ones who own the Federal Reserve, for example, its capital stock, It is a private company. Most people don't understand that, even at this late date. It's a private corporation. Its capital stock is owned by its bank, member banks, in proportion to the amount of capital they have. So the bigger banks own control of it. That's why the New York banks and the New York Federal Reserve are the most powerful aspects of the Federal Reserve. They have the most assets, and the Rothschilds are said to own 55% and controlling interest, therefore, in the Federal Reserve.
Okay. So they're the owners, call the shots.
They're not. And they have enough political power that to this day, we've never had a full audit. And frankly, the prospects of ever getting an honest one are almost nil.
And to me, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
And yet they're still in the position that they can pay by law anybody who works today or has any asset is to take this paper money that they produce. They can take the money themselves and buy any of these assets themselves, own the assets. The people then own the money, and the money is completely worthless and declared to be no longer acceptable to anybody, whether they're selling food or an automobile or anything else. We're just about at that stage. The rest of the world is trying to get strong enough militarily that they no longer have to accept the dollar. We're very close to that point right this minute. And we'll see how that comes out. But there are other nations of the world who are already in an alliance that is acting towards going back to a currency that is backed by gold, both for international trade and for other purposes, so that their people can be assured that the work they put out, the products they put out, actually get something of value in return instead of just paper.
Are you working with them at all or in communication with them?
I am not. I simply am not well enough connected with the powers of countries to be at that level. But I try to stay as well informed about where they are. There are people in high positions that feed information out, and I try to listen as carefully as I can to find out what stage we are at one time and another. I do know that international relations, because of these efforts, are not at all what we see in our mainstream press. And thank goodness that we have the internet and places such as our discussion today in order to get information from others as they observe what goings on are to be considered.
Okay, so the next time we bring you on, we're going to talk about the happenings after the Depression. We're going to talk about how the Fed actually operates. We're going to talk about the tech crash of 2000. We're going to talk about the 2008. We're going to talk about the missing trillions from our economy. And then I want to talk about where, if these other countries do end up, replacing the dollar for their monetary needs, what does that mean for the United States?
Yes.
So that will be a good, topics to talk in our next interview. And as we close up, can you tell people where they can get a copy of your book and where they can learn more about you?
I'd be happy to. My website is classicalcapital.com. Classicalcapital.com. My book is called The Fruits of Graft, Great Depressions Then and Now. And you'll find it also on Amazon.com. I have some reviews there by other people who've read it, and I'm very grateful for those. Anytime that someone can put down what the book has meant to them, it's certainly beneficial in getting a convincing word to others. So those two places are the primary ways to get it. It's not in bookstores. I'm sorry to say. But who knows, with an interview such as this, Sarah, we may have it everywhere pretty soon. So let's give it a try.
Okay, that sounds great. And we will have you back very soon so people can hear more of what you have to say. And for now, have an amazing day. And thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening today. That's all I have. We are going to have more segments with Wayne Jett. It's going to go from the Great Depression to 2008 and current. So you'll get a lot more historical facts on what's going on with the economic powers that be behind the scenes politically and how all this stuff is happening. Highly recommend for you to follow these episodes. They are just great with new information and a lot of astonishing facts. So again, sarahwestall.com. You can hear this again in all of my episodes. Also, I highly recommend that you sign up for my newsletter and you can get all the updates on what's going on with my show. And hopefully, if you like it, maybe you can support my show on Patreon. I'm under Sarah Westall on Patreon. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.